Guerrilla Radio, you know, whenever the question of peace or even an end to war is broached, invariably the Nazi qualifier is raised. But what about Hitler? Aren't there instances where good wars are necessary to defeat the forces of evil? Well, if ever, there was a loaded concept. Mickey Zed is the author of Post Woke, a weekly podcast emanating from his native New York City. He is, too, a past lecturer and political activist, current martial artist and physical trainer, author of a dozen books, and most importantly, perhaps, a sensei in the art of intellectual self-defense. A big part of that self-defense is discerning friend from foe and knowing when you're being led down the garden path. Mickey's recent piece at Post Woke, D-Day equals Disinformation Day, is the perfect primer to keep you out of the tangled weeds that are the good war narrative. Well, hello, Mickey.
Hello, Chris. Always great to talk to you and hear your voice.
Well, I'm pleased. It's been too long. It's like 5 months or something since we last talked. Mickey, I'm going to go off script right off the top. I'm seeing stuff about New York City right now that you guys are under a bit of an atmospheric disaster zone because of largely the fires north of you in Quebec.
It's you Canadians, as usual. It's obvious. But, yeah, I don't know if disaster is the right word. I'm not totally sure of all the specifics. But I will say that when I was out earlier today, it's obvious. It smells like a giant campfire, and the sky is an odd color. But New Yorkers pretty much en masse just put their masks back on, and I just couldn't help but look it around and just say, you know, this is the new security blanket, where if someone says to you there's reason to be scared, they now reach for the mask. And I don't know yet. I haven't done the homework. I don't know the specifics of what's in the air and whether any mask is useful, but I still saw it as sort of a symbolic gesture where it's like, you know, because I lived in New York, for example, after 9/11, and I could tell you what it smelled like and practically tasted like in the sky in my neighborhood for weeks and weeks afterwards. And there was no one walking around with masks, but now it's considered normal after having been normalized for a big chunk of the past 3 years.
Well, we've had this not so much last year, but the year before it was pretty bad with the fires from Washington and Oregon and California, even coming up here where we are on the West Coast. And I remember from that time, because at work it was brought up by the union as a safety issue, because I work out of doors, and it was the N95 and better masks were the only ones that they said would offer you any particulate protection, like the homemade ones, and that they're not fine enough and they don't fit properly, you know, and all the other reasons. But and then getting viruses is a whole nother thing altogether. But for this, for the heavy particulates of the forest fires, which I know that smell that you describe well, N95 and finer are what you're after. Well, okay, Mickey, so I began with the D-Day. D-Day was yesterday, the longest day, so-called by as Hollywood would have it. And I did, and I trust you too, gave the gory glory reruns a miss. But Mickey, for those ingesting, like, again, this good war pill, can you disabuse them, please, from the top about the twisted D-Day narrative they're being fed year in and year out?
I'd be happy to do so. And I will use, to start with, a very, very mainstream source, because I've been doing this a long time. My first book, which came out 23 years ago, it's called Saving Private Power, A Hidden History of the Good War, Good War in Scare Quotes. So I've been writing about this topic and speaking publicly about it and for a long time. And quite often people, as you might imagine, get very sensitive and get very they take it personally. So I'm going to quote from, here in the U.S., the National World War II Museum, which says on their website, let's be blunt, the German army lost World War II on the Eastern Front. For most of the war, 75 to 80% of the German army had to be deployed in the East. And then I then quote from Alexander Coburn, which would be certainly not mainstream, where he said that by the time of D-Day, the war had already been won by the Russians at Stalingrad. And he said, compared to these epic struggles on the Eastern Front, D-Day was a skirmish. Hitler's generals knew the war was lost, and the task was to keep the meeting point between the invading Russians and the Western armies as far east as possible. And so those facts are obviously in the longest day narrative are completely erased. And I will say on record that this is not a personal attack on certainly on anyone who stormed the beach at Normandy Beach. And I'm used to having people take it personal, so I feel the need to offer a caveat, but I am filling in context that I hope listeners could recognize is pretty important.
Well, that longest day was a long time ago now, and so I don't expect there's any survivors that actually took part still alive, and even their children are probably getting pretty long in the tooth by this time. Yeah. But is the offense that is taken, is it the offense of those that know firsthand, you know, about that? I mean, it looks like by the movies, that's the way I know it, that it was a horrifying and terrible thing, and Saving Private Ryan was the latest, but certainly not the only depiction of that long day. But is it the people's manufactured memories, you think, via yes. the media that is really the problem?
I would make the very strong assumption that that's the case, because when younger people, just like you're surmising here, I am not hearing from survivors, and I am sometimes hearing from children of survivors, but in general, I'm just hearing from people who were born and raised with a narrative here in the U.S. that is very, very seductive, that, you know, we defeated the ultimate evil, and we are the ultimate good, and we're the good guys, and that was a good war, and it was won by the greatest generation, and all these catchphrases. And to have that challenged is very disconcerting for people, because even folks who spent the last 3 years seriously challenging the COVID narrative can be deeply attached to this narrative, because it's almost as if they need to have a foundation somewhere. Like mm-hmm. they're lying to us now. Oh, this is terrible what they're doing. I yearn for the good old days when we knew good from evil and we went over there and kicked some Nazi ass. And I'm not obviously defending the Nazis, but as a purveyor of intellectual self-defense, I'm trying to say to people, the concept of propaganda didn't begin in March of 2020. And it's been really fascinating because, as you well know, I made a reputation on what was called the left long before the word woke was ever used the way it is now. And if I said anything that I'm saying to you now in front of leftists, for the most part, they would be open and amenable to it, because they were constantly questioning the government and the military-industrial complex. But then those same folks will line up to support and get jabs from Big Pharma, now that I'm writing against the COVID narrative, I have people from the right becoming my friends and subscribers who are really, really astutely questioning what's happening now, but getting perhaps a little confused at least by this narrative that I'm presenting. And what I'm trying my honest best to do as a free agent is to say to all across the ideological spectrum that it's a pretty safe stance to begin with the premise that you're being lied to. And then you start doing your homework to figure out the specifics, because obviously every case is different. And I figured part of the reason why I wrote my first book was this topic, and why I continue writing about it, is the endurance of this myth and the power of this myth is so intense that if I could get people to question this, I feel that it opens the door for questioning virtually anything that the government or the corporation and banks that own the government proclaim as truth.
Yeah, I use the 6 is 9 rule of thumb when it comes to information dissemination. Mickey, as somebody who's used to delivering cognitive dissonance to others, are you experiencing a little bit of that when you say, like, oh, some of my fellow travelers now are on the right, people that in years past you would say, what? You know, you'd never, if I picture myself in 30 years, I'm sitting around with the John Birchers or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah, and I take that as a blessing, because I will have to own up to it that when you're deeply ensconced on anywhere on the spectrum, and in my case, let's say I was a part of like the Counterpunch Znet left, where my articles went viral. I had a big following. I gave talks all over the U.S. in interviews, and was a go-to person on topics like this. I would readily admit I would have knee-jerk reaction to anything that would be considered in the right without giving them the benefit of the doubt that I should have been giving. And this strange scenario over the past 3 years where the bulk of my growing audience is coming from, I don't always just say right, but they're certainly not radical left. And then there wasn't a woke, such thing as woke when I was really, really writing for Counterpunch and all. It was just called radical left. The folks that I'm interacting with now, for the most part, see the radical left completely differently. And I'm recognizing from interacting with them that I missed out by not being more open-minded and not giving people more of the benefit of the doubt. And I also have gotten better, I'm very, very proud of this, of being able to connect with people as human beings and being okay with having things that we strongly disagree about. Although when I was in more of the hive mind of the left, and it was very seductive because I was a go-to person there, so it feeds your ego, I would make the mistake, like a lot of people do, of mistaking ideology as a baseline for friendship. Because when you suddenly don't agree with someone on something and they ditch you as a friend, you realize that was never a personal friendship, because true friends inevitably are going to have disagreements, sometimes strong disagreements. So it's turned into the cognitive dissonance has turned into a golden opportunity for me to expand my consciousness, because yes, it's disconcerting. Everything for the past 3 years is, but I find this is like, all right, this is pointing out some blind spots on my part. It's introducing to me to people that I wouldn't have even given a chance to interact with. But at the same time, there are struggles and disappointments when I see some of the same templates and blueprints on the left and the right. Their stances are different, but sometimes the mindset is the same, and that can be it can be kind of disappointing.
Well, nobody's immune. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Mickey Zed, or Z as he's known south of the border. He's the author of Post Woke, a weekly podcast emanating from his native New York. He's too a lecturer, political activist, current martial artist, and physical trainer. He's written a dozen books, and he is always telling you to keep your guard up. As part of the art of intellectual self-defense. Well, you know, Mickey, I ride a motorcycle, and when I'm riding around, it's pretty common that motorcyclists wave at each other as they go by, you know. Not all, like the Harley guys don't, but, there's a sort of an instant friendship, a bond, a commonality that reminds me of what you described. Although I imagine if I ran into a lot of these riders, you know, out of uniform, so to speak, that we probably wouldn't have a lot else in common. So I can't take it for granted that, we'd be buddies and we would agree on a lot of things other than what we agree on, which is motorcycles are great.
Yeah, that's an excellent comparison. It's absolutely fine. I mean, I grew up on the streets of New York playing all kinds of sports, for example, and there were guys that I hung out with that I played specific sports with, or when I went to gyms or boxing gyms or martial arts dojos, there would be a crew of people that would be my friends from there. And quite often sometimes other topics come up, but when you have a passion, let's say motorcycles, you could probably hang with those people you wave to maybe for hours talking about motorcycles before you even began to find out what else you disagree about. And by then you might be like, that's okay, let's just talk motorcycles because I love this topic. And I feel like there's nothing wrong with that. I don't know if you would necessarily call those people friends. That's a semantics thing of how you define a friend. But I've learned over the years that as enough time passes, I look back now saying the people who stayed in my life and stayed connected to me are folks that we're mutually comfortable disagreeing with on topics, but at a root level, we just have this friendship connection that isn't going to be shattered by something like politics.
Do you think that's the wisdom of age?
I don't want to. Yeah. That's a tough thing to say.
You don't
want to
out yourself.
Yes.
Well, okay.
but I think if there is such a thing of wisdom, a concept as wisdom, you could say that there is a longevity element to it, because if you're around long enough, you're going to make an awful lot more mistakes than someone who's not around as long as you, and you have more time to learn from experience. And if that's a definition of wisdom, then I would have to agree with that. But it takes time to let this stuff play out. Like when, let's say, Occupy Wall Street started now almost 12 years ago, and I felt really tight with that group of people. And it took time for me to be able to discern that it was a very much set of circumstances, place and time that created that connection. And it doesn't mean I didn't like some of these people and still interact with them, but our connection was more tenuous than it felt in the moment.
Well, you know, and I'm thinking of it more as a physiological moment. I'm not afraid to say that, you know, I'm just not as passionate as I used to be. Maybe it's my T count. I don't know. But I mean, I'm getting to an age, and part of not judging people is yeah, it's the experience. You know, life can be tough, and you know, you're not going to judge people too harshly because you know that it's been tough for you too. But also, you know, I don't have that fervor that I once did, and I think you need that to really get on a judging rampage of somebody who doesn't agree with the way you see the world.
Yeah, that sure sounds like wisdom, what you just described there. I mean, it really does. And it's kind of a weird – we're kind of dancing around it, because who wants to say out loud on a public show like, yeah, I'm pretty wise. I got all the wisdom. It sounds – it's so you're so set up to then do something foolish and disprove it. But what you just described is a sense of like whether or not you have – physiologically have the energy, you are emotionally choosing where you're delegating whatever mm-hmm. energy you have. And it sounds to me that you're just saying that's just not worth the finite amount of energy I have this given week. And if this person disagrees, and even if they say something rude online, how strongly and how much what motivation do I have to make this a hill I might die on? And I would definitely agree with you on that, because I think I kind of got into that. I had a very popular blog, Cool Observer, for a while, and that could be – I had a great group of people. So the comments threads – the comments there were better than average by far on the internet. But there were still times where I could get caught up in a multi-day flame war at that point in my life. And then by the time I eventually joined Facebook, I'm not on it anymore. I kind of just was some of these – was a person who – didn't even really comment on other people's pages. I didn't even impose my opinion. If I knew them personally, I might talk to them about something, but I would just consume what they were sharing, their thoughts, and put it together to help shape my own thoughts. But I made this decision at that point where it's just I can't delegate that energy. It can't be allocated in that direction because other things feel more important. And yes, as you get older, there's a perhaps. Less energy, but also more responsibilities and more interests. You just have more things to spread the energy out about, and fighting online just seems like, wow, that's just this, I can't think of any rational reason to do that.
Yeah, it's funny. As time goes by, and this is for the young folks in the audience, there's things that you were so interested in, and then all of a sudden you wonder did I care about that? You know, I mean, I can't yes. even remember why I gave a shit about that. But, you know, it seemed really important at the time. You've got another post up today when the good sick guys slaughter civilians with God's permission. Are they still good guys? And you've got an excellent cover of your other excellent book, One of the Many, The Seven Deadly Spins. And this is concerning. I remember, you know, talking about Hollywood earlier and the D-Day invasion and all that. There was a film that was quite a big blockbuster film. You know, that term blockbuster refers to blowing up whole blocks of cities. But it was called The Dam Busters.
Yep.
And it was all about, you know, the struggle, I think it was the English, to develop a bomb that could blow up a very large and well-defended German dam during the Second War. Well, we've seen a less well-defended and less ingenious attempt and a successful one made to blow up the dam in Ukraine, Russia. I'm not sure, you know, they're disputing about the very definition. What's your piece telling us, your latest piece here, When the Good Guys Slaughter Civilians?
Well, to be radically honest, it's actually a slightly older piece that when I saw the news of the dam explosion in Ukraine, I saw everybody rushing to judgment to the latest Hitler, Putin, as you touched on earlier. I said this is a good time to resurrect this story where I wrote about how the context of the story was saying that of the 185 Nazis were indicted at Nuremberg, but only 24 were singled out for the death penalty. And that's so you figure, wow, what did they do? But among those two dozen were the people who blew up Dutch dikes to slow the advance of Allied troops. And there was mass starvation because acres were flooded. And so they ended up, you could argue they were considered the worst of the worst, because they're the ones that were singled out to be executed. But then fast forward just not that long after that to the Korean War, and you see how the good guys bombed the Toksan Dam, among others, which the goal was to flood North Korea's rice farms. So they were committing this mass murder, this slow mass murder, because they're starving them to death, that just like, what, 7 years earlier or 6 years earlier was considered one of the worst things the Nazis did. And then fast forward a little bit after that, and now we're in Vietnam, and the bombing of dams became normal. And I tell a little anecdote in there that the evangelist Billy Graham, who was close with Richard Nixon, Graham met with him and spoke to missionaries who went to Southeast Asia and was urging Nixon and telling him which dikes to blow up that could destroy the economy of North Vietnam. And this is coming from this noted evangelist. And the dam busting by the U.S. never stopped. And I give one example. In 2017, there was a bombing of a dam on the Euphrates River in Syria. So when I wrote the original piece, the idea was to say how if you can rationalize in your mind that, well, the U.S. had to do that in Korea, they had to do it in Vietnam, they had to do it in Syria, then I'm saying, well, do you realize that after the good war, the epitome of evil, the exemplar of evil that's going to be compared for who knows how much longer, we're going to use Nazis as the comparison and the next Hitler as the label, they only 24 of them were executed after Nuremberg, and the bulk of them were involved in blowing up dams and starving people through flooding. And the good guys, the Greatest Generation and their ensuing descendants, are doing the same thing. So now when this dam gets blown up, and I don't know the specifics yet, and I'm not pretending I do, but there might be a reasonable chance that the Russians did it. So the narrative for everyone who's listening, if you keep an eye on it, the narrative is going to be that Putin once again is at it doing his Hitler-like war crimes. So we can't have it both ways. Like, so he's – what he's doing theoretically would make Billy Graham nice and happy and drop to his knees and praise God that oh yeah, this is what you do when you starve people, you flood out their fields and you commit war crimes in order to win war. So I'm not defending any of the people who blew up these dams, but like I was doing earlier with D-Day, I feel like you can't have a full contextual opinion on this world event without understanding some history behind it.
Well, yeah, and as Mr. Graham or Reverend Graham may say, let God sort them out. Well, this is an excellent opportunity for a mental thought experiment, because you can talk about this dam and the way it's being presented and then make your judgments and then find out that the opposite is the case, because this dam, like the Nord Stream pipeline, was controlled by Russia. The destruction of it, like the Nord Stream pipeline, hurts Russia. It doesn't help it in any way, in fact. Mm-hmm. And it's already been revealed publicly that the Ukrainian forces practiced blowing up this dam and publicly said that they were going to do it, just like what happened with Nord Stream. So even though Zelensky has petitioned the International Criminal Court to prosecute for the dastardly deed of blowing this dam up, the fact is that he is the author of this disaster. But will that be recognized in the Western press? I don't know. But don't stop letting people damn Putin for blowing up the dam, because the shoe will quickly be on the other foot. And that's the case here in my humble reading of the situation right now. Mickey, we don't have a lot of time. And I can't leave you before talking about another of your pieces. And again, Mickey's Substack site is Mickey Z, or Z if you're American, .substack.com. And this one is Big Pharma Keeping Us in, quote, pandemic mode. Now, you've mentioned the COVID a little bit. Here we are. How long has it been now, Mickey? Jesus Christ. 3 and something years since all of this began.
3 years, 3 months about.
Yeah. Okay. So what's this? What do you mean keep us in pandemic mode? That thing is ancient history. I don't want to hear anymore.
And here we are talking about World War II, but we don't want, this is ancient history. But I just want to say kudos to the damn Putin line that you got in there. You worked that in there. That was nice. Mm-hmm. It was really good wordplay. The piece that I put up today was inspired by an article that I happened upon that's published in mainstream, Harvard Health Publishing, warning consumers that pharmaceutical ads are very deceptive, breaking news. So I share some information that since 1997, the U.S. is only one of two countries on the planet, the other one being New Zealand, that allows direct-to-consumer advertising for health products like medication and procedures like on television. And it has become a major source of income for the media. The pharmaceutical industry pumps so much money into the media. And someone commented on the article today that he pointed out, very, I believe accurately, that it guarantees this level of billions and billions that's being – tens of billions that are being pumped into the media. It virtually guarantees that the major media figures are not going to challenge the narratives, because it's this little agreement here where, you know, we're going to pay – we're going to advertise like crazy, and you're going to just kind of push things under the rug. So at the same time, the article also points out that the language that they use in these ads is so consciously and actually pretty in an amateurish way obvious that there's, for example, when they say such and such a drug is a leading treatment for this condition, the person in the Harvard article said, perhaps, but what if there are only 2 or 3 drugs available for that condition? And when considering any treatment, it's important to know what other options are and how they compare, yet it's unlikely this additional information will be mentioned. Now, I give several other examples in there if people want to go to Mickey's. Substack.com, but it's I felt like in light of where we're at now, this was a pretty relevant bit of information to share.
Well, and it's an excellent example of practicing intellectual self-defense. And I would, if we went longer, spend more time on that, because it's hilarious. I mean, in a dark and brooding way, yeah. like the pill with all filled with little skulls. And too bad we don't have doctors. You've got another piece on there about called Doctors' Lies. And it's a great piece about how your doctor as a kid, when doctors still made house calls, lied to your mother about a condition. Well, you're going to have to go to Mickey's site to find out how that story ends. It's Mickey, letterz.substack.com. That's MickeyZ.substack.com. Mickey, it's always a joy to speak with you. I prefaced our piece with a bit of your friend Allison Gray's from when we had wings.
When humans had wings.
When humans had wings. Thank you. And I'll go out with as much of that as we can. I want to also thank Nick Moturn from bandkillerdrones.org from coming on. Thanks a lot for coming on and speaking again with us, man. And I'll talk to you again real soon. I hope, we keep that mask wherever you want to keep it.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's always so much fun.
All right. Till the next time.